Welcome to the Lifeway Student Ministry Podcast. I'm Ben Trueblood. With us today in the room, John Paul Basham.
Yo.
Mary Margaret.
Hello.
I never know. The name is really long. Is
I have that, a very
do you want
long
last name.
Name
to be in there?
Well, sure. Mary Margaret Collingsworth.
Mary Margaret Collingsworth.
It kind of scares people off sometimes. I'm not going to lie.
The long name. Well, we want to thank you for listening to the Lifeway Student Ministry Podcast. If you haven't taken the 30 seconds to head over to iTunes and leave us a rating and review, we would love for you to do that. It helps other student ministry leaders find this podcast. So thanks for doing that. We are super excited to have a special guest with us today on the podcast. Johnny Moore is with us. Johnny, how are you?
I'm doing good.
Great.
How are you guys doing?
We're wonderful. I am anyway.
Yeah.
You guys?
I am great as well.
The other guys are like, speak for yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so you guys know a little bit more about Johnny. He is an author, speaker, media personality, communications executive, humanitarian, who's been called one of the most influential young leaders in the world. And this one's awesome. I've been referred to as a modern day Dietrich Bonhoeffer.
So that's a big deal.
It is. And so we're thrilled to have Johnny. He's appeared regularly on Religion News Service, Washington Post, CNN, Fox News, is the author of 4 books. The latest one, which is what we're going to spend the majority of our time on the podcast today, is called The Martyr's Oath. So, Johnny, we're super glad that you're here. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us about your book and to talk to us, more importantly, about the stories that you have seen and heard as you've traveled the world and discovered more about global Christianity and the state of persecution as it exists. Student pastors listening, you're going to want to tune in to this episode because this is an issue that your students, I would wager, don't think about, never crosses their mind in a normal day, but it is absolutely critical that their minds and their eyes are open to what God is doing around the world and to how Christians are being persecuted around the world. So, Johnny, I would throw it to you just at the beginning. What kind of sent you on your journey to write Martyr's Oath and to dive in more deeply to persecuted Christianity around the world?
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, one of the reasons why, you know, for me, I jumped at the opportunity to be on this podcast with you guys is because of the role of youth pastors in my own life, you know, as a kid. And, you know, my parents went through a pretty dramatic divorce, you know, when I was 12, 13 years old. You know, we went through a very, very difficult time, and one of the only reasons why I was able to get through it is because of the youth pastors at my local church. You know, but growing up in the deep South of the United States, you know, I understood the Bible, like I got the stories, I got it. You know, I could quote Bible verses not because I'd memorized them, but because I'd heard them 1,000 times, and yet I felt like there was this absence in my faith, like there was just something missing, and I only found it when I was in college and I experienced firsthand the life of persecuted Christians, you know, around the world. And I went to India. I attended a Bible school graduation in India. There were 2,000 graduates. And yet before they were given their diploma, they all had to stand and they had to recite a martyr's oath. You know, that's why I called the book The Martyr's Oath. They had to confess that if their faith cost them something, even their life, they were willing to make that sacrifice. And it wasn't that the school was trying to provoke them to become martyrs. It's just the reality of the world that they faced meant that their faith was going to cost them something, and it could cost them their lives. And the school didn't feel good about giving them a diploma and sending them on a mission unless they knew what it might cost them. And I remember standing in that moment, you know, as a student at Liberty University, and feeling like I was standing in the book of Acts. And finally, you know, so much of the Bible that I'd read and known since I was a child came to life for me. And, you know, so I'm just convinced that we can't really have the Christian life that a lot of us are seeking unless we're either suffering or we are close to those who are. And so that's why I've decided to write their stories.
Yeah. You talk about that experience in the book and being there in India and just, I guess awe is an appropriate word for what you experienced in witnessing that moment. So you added just now, like, experience suffering or being close to those who do. And I think that's an important component of this, especially when we think about teenagers in America and helping them become closer to those who are persecuted. Because there are a lot of people that anticipate or say or project that, hey, we're going to begin to experience more Christian persecution in our country over time. Obviously, that's nothing compared to what you write about in the book, specifically with this, and we can get to this in just a minute, with the story that, you relay of Rose and what she experienced in that story. There's no one that's experiencing to that level probably here in our country. So how would you recommend to student ministry leaders that they, a way that they can help their teenagers and even themselves as leaders become close, like you said, to those who are persecuted?
Well, I mean, listen, you cannot read the New Testament without encountering the persecuted church on almost every other page. I mean, our book and our story, you know, as Christians for 2,000 years has been that we've been a persecuted people. And so much of the New Testament only comes alive when taught within that circumstance. But, you know, one of the things that I think we don't realize in our churches and in our religious freedom in the United States is that we are living in a unique moment in Christian history where we have more Christian personnel than at almost any moment, if at any moment in Christian history. I mean, you know, the Pope, you know, in the Catholic Church says there are more martyrs today than in the combined history of Christianity. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have Christians, you know, the most conservative estimate is in 60 countries around the world, you know, who are suffering intensely for their faith. You know, everybody knows about Iraq and Syria, right? We lost 80% of the Christians in Iraq and 50% of the Christians in Syria, you know, but people don't talk about Nigeria, where, you know, terrorists killed more Christians last year than ISIS did in Syria, or Turkey, where, you know, now fewer than 1% of the Turkish population is Christian, and, you know, more than half of the population of Istanbul, Turkey, used to be Christian, you know, a generation ago. Like this is a moment of history that we're living in, and it's for youth pastors, they need to recognize, and youth leaders and volunteers that, you know, at churches that serve students, you know, they need to recognize that they need to genuinely care passionately about this issue, and they need to help invest in their students so their students find it. Because I think you find your faith when you find the persecuted church, because, you know, otherwise it's just sort of a club that we're in. You know, it's not that different from school, except for the, you know, the spiritual element of it. But if we're going to see the gospel as powerful as it is, you know, for a lot of us, at least for me, you know, it came through the stories of these people around the world. And so when I wrote The Martyr's Oath, you know, my team and I, we crisscrossed the globe. We interviewed people in dozens of countries. We documented their stories, and we wrote their exact words. And in part, you know, hoping that people in churches all across the country, especially those who deal with students, would tell those stories to their students and give the gift of understanding the cost of this faith. You know, these believers, you know, as the subtitle of the book says, these believers are willing to die for a Jesus we're barely willing to live for. And so if we have the same Jesus, we have the same gospel, we need to find out what they know about it that either we don't know or we're not effectively conveying to another generation. And it comes through the stories.
Johnny, as you've been talking just now, it made me think of something that I think we maybe do unintentionally, maybe just because of the way that the comfortable conservative Christian audience in America filters everything. We tend to not want to get out of our comfort zone in any way, because that is just like is implied in the name comfort zone. We like to be comfortable. So often when we talk about the persecuted church, or we talk about persecution in other countries, I think a lot of times we, to make that a little bit more palatable, we immediately go to, yes, there are other places in the world that are seeing real persecution, but look how the church is flourishing under that persecution. And so I think we immediately jump from people are being persecuted, but let's not look at how ugly that is. Let's look at the fact that God's church will never fail and that it is flourishing in spite of what the world is trying to do. But you and others are writing these books and trying to get these stories out to say, no, let's look at how ugly this is. Let's look at what the church is having to endure. Let's look at what real lives are suffering through. How do you think? I think it's important to show both. Yes, that the church is flourishing underneath that persecution, but I think it's important to bring students into the reality of how ugly persecution is. How do you think we do that well?
I think it is recognizing it is two sides of the same coin. Like, you know, the church is triumphing, and yet the church is suffering. And, you know, in the West, we don't really have the vocabulary and the, you know, when we explain these stories to our students, you know, I was a college pastor for 13 years, you know, at Liberty University. And I used to, you know, I'd have to paint a picture, you know, my students, you know, coming from, you know, different parts of this country. I mean, they didn't even know what it was like to be these people. And they hadn't seen a movie like this. They hadn't been to these places, and we have to work to convey the suffering, the experience, the stories, to humanize it. But, you know, these are our family members. You know, the Bible says if one member of the body suffers, we all suffer. Mm-hmm. So it's like our brother, our sister, our mother, our father. You know, when ISIS was selling children as slaves, you know, on slave markets by age and by religion, you know, starting from 1 to 9 years old, you could buy a Christian or Yazidi girl. You know, that we have to care like that's our little sister, you know, that they're selling. And then we have to pray, and then we have to work and be an advocate for these people. And we have to do that. And in these stories, you get both sides of the coin. Like, you know, here's a really simple story. I could, you know, tell it in a minute. You know, and it's a family that I met that in a neighboring country to Syria. They had fled Syria, and they were Christians. And I was sitting across the table from them in this church not far from the border. And they started telling their story, and their story was that a family member in Syria who was a jihadist had written them a letter, and the letter said, "We know where you are, and we're going to come to you, and we're going to crucify you like you're Jesus." Now, I'm sitting across the table from these people, and I just can't believe this story. And I even more couldn't believe their response, because they said, this is literally what they said, guys. I mean, they said, "We wrote him back, and our letter said, please, we're more than willing to die for Jesus, but please don't crucify us, because we're not worthy to die the same death as our Lord," right? Wow. And in both sides of the story, you see the triumph of the gospel, you see the cost of the gospel. And I just think there's a missing piece for so many young people that grow up in the church, and they have the New Testament talks about this. You know, there's a form of godliness with no power. Hmm. And this is why we risk losing a generation. We've got to get them closer to the New Testament. And the New Testament is alive in the suffering church in the dark corners of our world.
Yeah, and it really makes me think of, you know, so many people that when you have questions, you know, or conversations about suffering, you know, so many people's first question is why me, you know, rather than saying why not me. And, you know, and I think we've got to dig into what you're saying in the New Testament, where it is this, it's kind of flipping our cultural norms on their head to say, you know, why not me? Because, you know, I would, you know, die for the sake of Christ. I would lay down my life, you know, because he's laid down his life for me. And I think sometimes we've made it too easy for students. And so we've got to make sure that they have an understanding of what it does look like and give some exposure to that so that they can see a bigger picture of, you know, not only what's happening around the world, but what's happening in our own country too. So I'm, you know, we're grateful that you did that. And, you know, I love that in your book, you talk about forgiveness is a big aspect of, you know, some of these people are willing to forgive the people who have, you know, who've treated them, you know, so terribly. And so like, how does that element, you know, come into play, or how have you seen that flesh itself out when it comes to forgiveness in very difficult situations?
You know, it's an amazing thing about the suffering church around the world. Like, you know, we struggle to forgive our neighbor, you know, or the kid that made fun of us in school or something. Yet they forgive their executioners, their murderers, you know, the families of the suicide bomb. I mean, they forgive them, you know, in recent weeks, I've gotten to know the Egyptian church, recent months, I've gotten to know the Egyptian church really well. And, you know, I've been amazed at how the Egyptian church, despite an incredible amount of suffering, you know, terrorists are trying to turn Egypt upside down. You know, it's not the government so much that persecutes Christians in Egypt, it's terrorists that are attacking Christians and also attacking the government, you know, and there's some exceptions in some local towns, but, you know, most of the the publicized acts of persecution of late, you know, have been terrorists attacking these people. And yet every time it happens, you know, the Egyptian church just publicly says they forgive them. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, one pastor in Cairo delivered an entire message, and the message was entitled, quote, "A Message to Those Who Kill Us." And in the message, he's talking to the terrorists and he's saying, you know, "I want you to know we forgive you. I want you to know we're praying for you. Mm-hmm. I want you to know the Lord who told us to pray for you also told us to forgive you. And so we do," you know, and it's not, they don't argue with themselves. I mean, this is just, they read the New Testament. The New Testament says they're supposed to do this. And so they do it, you know, and we rationalize and we argue. And, you know, here's the classic one, you know, all over northern Iraq and Syria, Christians were faced with the question of converting or being killed, right? So convert or die. You know, and as Baptists, you know, that don't believe, you know, that you can lose your salvation, you're right. We, as Baptists, we believe in eternal security, you know, and you know, I'm a Baptist. I happen to be one. And so I sit down, I talk to friends of mine, you know, and we're like, well, if some guy came up to my house and said, convert or die, I mean, if I can't lose my salvation, like, you know, God will forgive me for that little lie. Maybe I'll live to fight another day, or maybe I'll stay and I'll win the whole, you know, terrorist Christ or something. And yet, when you have a conversation like that with an Iraqi Christian, as I've done in Iraq, they look at you like you're an alien. You know, it's like, but how can you deny Jesus? It's such a part of their identity. It's not possible to do. You know, and I think it says something about their faith versus our faith. It says something about our hearts. And if we're going to teach our students the New Testament, we have to teach them about the suffering church. And we have a living New Testament in the world we're living in today. There are Pauls converted on the road to Damascus in the world we're living in today, every single day. I mean, you know, what I encountered writing the Martyr's Oath is story after story of amazing, miraculous conversions, supernatural things, people willing to suffer and to lose everything for Jesus. It's like, you know, the New Testament is alive and well. That's not some story from 2,000 years ago. That's like the 21st century in living color.
Yeah, and I want to hear a couple of those stories. But before we do, I think it's important, listeners, that you understand this about Johnny, that he didn't just travel and gather stories and write a book, but this is something, again, going back to college, that became a passion that you advocate for, you do humanitarian work for, that that other organizations, like we have the Iraqi Chaldean Diocese of San Diego has honored you for your work and what you're doing and speaking and advocacy and humanitarian work. So listeners, I want you to understand this. We're not just talking to somebody who's passionate in word about this, but is also passionate in deed and is, I mean, Johnny, you're doing and acting upon what you've seen all the time. And I love that. And I just felt like we should pause and make sure that our listeners know that this is a both and for you. That is, it's a passion that you've written about, but you've written about it because you've been acting on it for so many years.
Well, you know, compassion requires action, right? I mean, it doesn't require big action, but it does require some action. And you know, I think a lot of times we think that caring is enough, and caring isn't enough. Like, you need to care and you need to pray, or care and give, or care and go, or care and advocate, or care and whatever. You know, and in my case, I mean, it's become very clear to me over the years that, you know, this is a call on my life. I have a responsibility to speak up for these people. And even in times and seasons of life where I've not intentionally focused on it, it's amazing how it has found me. And, you know, I think that it's the responsibility of all of us to find our part in the story of our suffering brothers and sisters. And we all need to do something. If you care, you've got to act. And, you know, I think in the New Testament, we have a culture that was aware of and involved with the persecuted church, and it shouldn't change. I mean, in our, you know, we shouldn't have a one Sunday a year where we focus on this issue. We ought to do it 52 weeks a year. We pray for the persecuted church. Like, this is who the Christian church is. It's who we've been, you know, and we need to do more of it. And I got to tell you too, like, as much as I've tried to help these people, and, you know, by the grace of God, I've been able to help a lot of people, yet as much as I help them, I find they help me more. Like, mm-hmm. I, It has changed my life. The closer I've gotten to these people, it's no service. In fact, I feel it's unfair, you know, that I have gotten to know these people around the world and been blessed by them.
Well, let's camp out there for just a minute, because that kind of leads us to this next part of where I wanted to go is, how have these stories affected you? Like, what are some things you mentioned? You know, Mary Margaret asked about the forgiveness and how that is such an amazing visible representation of Jesus in someone's life, to be able to look at the murderers and experience forgiveness. And you mentioned so many stories of miraculous things and conversion moments and suffering and persecution. Which ones have stood out to you, and how have those affected you even recently?
Well, you know, I remember going to Northern Iraq, weeks after ISIS took Mosul, and you know, the Christians were still in the streets, and they were in schools and unfinished buildings. 50,000 had to flee within hours from one Iraqi Christian village when ISIS moved in. And yet, you know, on that very day I was there, you know, ISIS was at their height. You know, they were 15 kilometers from Erbil. They were 20 kilometers. They were 15 kilometers from the Baghdad airport. Like, this was a hot war, and they were still chasing after these people. And yet the Christians, when they set up their tents, you know, in the middle of the nowhere, one of the first things they did is they put crosses at the entrances of their tents. You know, they weren't trying to hide. You know, they hadn't run away from their faith when they had run away from their homes. You know, they were not ashamed of the cross of Jesus Christ. And, you know, I just remember looking at these people thinking, you know, would I be so bold, or would I be hiding, you know, in the shadows? And, you know, I met this nun, until I started working in the Middle East, I hadn't spent much time with very many Catholics, especially nuns. And I met this nun. It's like a humanitarian. She was a Mother Teresa of Northern Iraq. I mean, it's the only way I know how to describe her. And, you know, I'm having a conversation with her late at night in her displaced house, you know, in Erbil. And she said to me, she said, "Johnny, I love America." She said, "It's a wonderful country, beautiful people." She said, "I have a doctorate degree from an American university." You know, she was a highly educated nun. And then she said these words. She said, "In your country, you take care of your pets so well." And then she said, "So when will you care for us?" She said, "Why are you so silent in the face of our genocide?" And she was speaking to the church. You know, that's who she was speaking to. She was speaking to us, you know, the Christians in the West, who would have no church history if it wasn't for Christians in the East. You know, I think we think sometimes that our Christianity started in like Nashville or Dallas, you know, but it didn't. You know, it started in the Middle East. And in Northern Iraq, I mean, they still speak the language of Jesus. I mean, they speak the very dialect of Jesus, these Christian communities in Northern Iraq, and they've preserved that for 2,000 years. And yet, what an insult it is for us to like act like they don't even exist. And, you know, I remember that nun telling me how forgotten they felt. And I made her a promise that I would tell their stories. And, you know, it's not just Iraq. I mean, it's all over the world. I mean, we met Christians in China who had, you know, been in prison. And before they went into prison, you know, their church met in the basement of a house. But they came out of prison so bold that the Chinese believer told us that now they meet underneath the sun, like they just don't care anymore. Mm. You know, it's just a, you know, we met you know, this woman in Nigeria whose life was destroyed. I mean, you know, Boko Haram came to her house in the middle of the night, and you mentioned her earlier, Rose, and you know, they beheaded her husband and her children in front of her eyes, and she was pregnant, and they're chasing her as she runs outside of the house. And demanding these jihadists that she say Allah Akbar. You know, they were trying to forcibly convert her on the spot. And she told us with a voice still raspy because of, as they chased her, they were cutting at her with the same knives that they'd used to kill her husband and children. And she ran and ran and ran. They were demanding she say Allah Akbar. And she said to us, she said, every single time they told me to say Allah Akbar, as I ran, I looked over my shoulder and I screamed at them, Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. And you know, she'd lost everything, literally everything. I mean, everything. And yet, you know, her faith was the one thing she not only had not lost, but it was sustaining her through her suffering. And, you know, I think we need to ask ourselves, and we need to ask for those that we teach and lead, the students of the Christian church in the United States of America, would our life be any different without our Christianity? And, you know, I am scared to say that, you know, maybe not. You know, maybe our Christianity is just an add-on, you know, it's part of our social lives. And yet for the suffering church around the world, you know, it is their life. You know, 2,000 years ago, when Christians converted, when people converted to Christianity, they didn't say that they had become Christians, right? They said they had received Zoe, you know, life. They'd gotten life. They'd gotten new life. And I think we've lost that, you know, in our faith. Like, it's not living and breathing, you know, when we come to Jesus Christ. It's just that compared to our previous life, it doesn't even look like life anymore. And their Christianity and their life in the suffering church is so intermingled, so intertwined, you can't separate the two from one another. And it sustains them. And, you know, it really is amazing. I mean, we met a guy, in the Middle East, who works in a number of different countries. I mean, this guy is the modern day Apostle Paul. I mean, you know, the amount of suffering he's gone through and the churches he's planted and the life he's living, you know, it's like we were sitting across from, you know, God duplicating the story of history, and miss so much by missing these people.
I think what you said about, I mean, gosh, this nun asking the question, when will you care about mm-hmm. us? That is just like a knife in my chest in this moment. That's one of those kind of, well, it's not kind of, it is a knot in my throat right now.
Yeah.
It is a heart-wrenching question that I think we all need to ask ourselves in the American church. And I think it really is that those people, those cultures have been not necessarily forgotten, because that would imply that we've talked about it before and have forgotten to talk about it now. I think they're literally unknown.
Yeah, ignored.
Unknown, to the American church. Yep. And so you telling these stories is something that, I mean, you're championing these stories. You're championing these people, the church internationally, everything that is going on overseas that we aren't seeing, in a way that has to be done. But the real question for us, as we're kind of pointing this to student ministry leaders, is how do we create a culture in student ministries that is willing to have these conversations?
Yeah.
Because I can hear student ministry leaders saying, man, this is going to be so heavy. And a lot of times we think about, you know, okay, what's the next game that we do? You know, what's the next big event? What's the next, you know, how do we generate this momentum to get students in the door? And if we had this conversation with some of these persecuted Christians, how do we get more students in the door to tell them about Jesus? I think that they would just kind of laugh in our faces to say, really? That's what you're thinking about? So,
well, and the students do the work for us when they get the fire of the gospel mm-hmm. lit in their hearts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think what I found at Liberty, right? And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I was the campus pastor at Liberty University. So maybe I had one of the largest student ministries in the world, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And what I found is when I could get a student close to the persecuted church, they made my ministry so much easier, because they were doing the work. They were bringing their friends. They were discipling, you know, by their lifestyle, not just by their teaching. And I think that, you know, it's sort of a, it's a misnomer that investing in this subject is a downer. Actually, it's sort of the opposite. You know, mm-hmm. it lights a fire. And you know, I think, you know, in and around certain, like Easter, right, where we're, you know, the story of Jesus is the story of, like, the first persecuted Christian, you know, crucified, in the way Christians are crucified in certain parts of the world today, right? And, you know, killed for what he believed and what he was teaching. Like, you know, what if we did, you know, small group curriculum around that for a couple of weeks? You know, what if we just inserted these stories every, you know, a story every three or four messages? And it's not a message about the persecuted church. It's just an illustration of someone who's lost something. And then we create this culture. You know, one of the reasons why it's so strange when someone comes in and talks about it, you know, and is that we're not talking about it regularly. You know, and you read the letters of the Apostle Paul, and he's always mentioning someone that's suffering, right? Mm. And suffering for their faith. And he mentions them by name. You know, they're known by name. You know, what if our students in our student ministries were praying by name for believers, you know, around the world that needed it? I mean, I just think that we would not have the churches to contain the lives. Yeah. if we somehow locked into this part of our Christian story. You know, it's a fan into flame, the gift of God that's in the hearts of these kids. And that first spark is often an encounter with someone whose faith has cost them something. You know, at least that's been the case in my experience. And we just, you know, there are lots of great resources, you know, the amazing books and published by Lifeway. They're great ministries that publish live information about what's happening to the persecuted church around the world. We just got to create a culture, you know, and when the news hits and it's a nation that's a persecuted place, or on the other side, the positive things that are happening, you know, there are amazing things happening all across the Middle East to help Christians. You know, we have the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia 2 weeks ago saying his vision is for Saudi Arabia to be a nation for all religions. Mm. You know, in Bahrain, which is connected by bridge to Saudi Arabia, a couple of months ago, you know, a few of us helped with something called the Bahrain Declaration that was calling for religious freedom all across the Middle East and saying that people ought to be able to change their beliefs, you know, condemning forced observance, you know, which is a forced Islam, you know, is what it was condemning, essentially. You know, I was fortunate to meet with the president of Egypt a few weeks ago, and he you know, was emotionally broken, you know, as he had to tell the story about churches that had been destroyed in his country. And he promised that not only would it never happen again, but he told us about how he had personally ordered that those churches be rebuilt at the expense of the government. Like, you know, God is working in the world we're living in today. And I think we're so worried sometimes about the trivial things that the movement of God just comes, it just flies right past us. And that is the answer, you know, to all of our programming and all of our efforts and everything. It's not one or the other, you know, it's both and. But I can tell you, I think too often we invest too little in the sheer power of the gospel to transform people's lives.
I feel like I just want to be your intern right now.
That's right.
I could send you to some interesting places.
I love that. You know, and this has made me think. I had this thought in my head, and then you talked about fanning this into flame. And that's, you know, I think the question that I want to ask you is how would you encourage a student pastor today to fan this into flame for some of their students who are reading and understanding and grasping these thoughts, you know, that are seeds that have been planted, whether it's, you know, by an article or a book that they've read, whether it's by a message that they've heard, but they're understanding what's going around in the church around the world. And so how would you encourage student pastors today to latch on and fan the flame into those students?
Yeah, I think, you know, aside from teaching and telling these stories and integrating it into the student ministry, I think the next step is prayer. You know, there's something about saying, like, every Wednesday night, you know, 15 minutes before the service starts in X room, you know, we're going to just pray for the persecuted church. It's not going to take very long, but we're going to come together and we're going to, you know, go to Open Doors or something and get some information. And we're going to pray specifically for countries. And, you know, I think one of the things that we also lose, you know, in the free church, as I like to call us in the West, you know, is in the suffering church, you know, prayer is like the beating heart of it. I mean, yeah. It's blood inside your veins. And for me, that's the next step. I mean, it really is this intense, intense prayer for these people. And then just do practical things to help them. You know, like something like 80% of the housing needs in northern Iraq are still unmet for Christians. And we think the UN and all these big aid organizations are going to take care of it, you know, but international government organizations. But, you know, it's actually the non-governmental organizations that are taking care of this problem. And they're, you know, for whatever reason, the United Nations and others won't touch it, but they're great Christian organizations that will. And, you know, instead of, you know, help the local community, but also help the world, you know, help suffering Christians, give to these organizations, like create a culture of action, you know. And I think we think of prayer as something that we do, but it's sort of the only thing, you know, that the suffering church does in many circumstances. And it's no surprise that the church is actually, you know, in an attempt to destroy the Christian church in these difficult places, we've actually, you know, it's true. Like the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church, and the stories that I can't tell from countries like Syria are amazing. What God is doing in our time.
So you mentioned compassion has to lead to action. You mentioned building a culture of taking action on this. What are some specific? So hopefully, as student ministry leaders have listened to this podcast, their hearts will be kindled to this, to spread awareness, to take action, to really lay hold of the responsibility to carry these stories to another generation that they work with and continue to get the word out. What are some specific places that they can go to do more research, to take action? What are some handholds that you can give them?
Yeah, well, let me just start with myself. Like, you know, in addition to the Martyr's Oath, which are these stories, you know, from 30 countries around the world, you know, to answer this what to do question, I wrote an additional little pamphlet, and it's called The 10 Things That You Need to Know About the Global War on Christianity. The 10 Things You Need to Know About the Global War on Christianity. And it's just a couple of bucks, you know, on Amazon. And it is for the purpose of, it's like 80 pages of just educating people, and here are the practical things that you can do, you know. And I think that that's a good cheap resources that people can get just to know what to do, you know. And in Easter, you know, there's a devotional called We Are One, you know, that is a 40-day journey, you know, with the persecuted church that I've prepared for around that season, you know, this year. So those are things that I've worked on. But then there are amazing organizations, like, you know, I'm a huge fan of Open Doors International. When I was writing The Martyr's Oath, I went over to Holland and I visited with Brother Andrew, you know, who founded and famously took millions of Bibles over into the communist world during the Cold War, and in one night in China, arrived with a barge of 1 million Bibles and distributed them within minutes through the port, you know, in something called Operation Pearl. And his legacy lives on. He's an old man now, and you know, he's not so active, but I'll never forget the time I spent with him. But his legacy lives on, you know, through Open Doors. It's an amazing organization doing incredible work, and I just encourage people to look there, you know. And practically speaking, I mean, you got to educate yourself, you got to learn from these people, you got to pray for these people, you got to be an advocate for these people. You know, our politicians around the world need to hear from us on this issue. You know, they need to know, like, when people ask what you care about, well, one of the things I care about is religious freedom abroad, you know, that Christians and others, you know, can worship free from fear. Like, you know, this needs to be something we advocate for, you know, and then give help.
And that's something you've done. You've taken this to Capitol Hill, which I think is something that the church often feels like they are powerless to do.
Well, you know, in the middle of the most divided time, perhaps, in American history, you know, we were involved in getting unanimous genocide resolutions against ISIS passed in both houses of Congress. Not a single Democrat or Republican voted against it. They all voted for it. And it's because we raised our voice. And, you know, Christians in this country are influential. And, you know, we it doesn't mean we have to be political, but it does mean that influence is a stewardship, and we need to be responsible with our voices, you know, to help people in need. And there are people that are helped today that would not have been helped had we not had the courage as the collective body of Christ around this country to raise our voice. You know, it matters. And by the way, what matters more than, like, going to Washington, D.C. often is going to your local, you know, congressman's office. And, you know, 10 phone calls or 10 emails there make a much bigger difference than 1,000, you know, in the halls of Congress, because they know you're local and you care. And, you know, this makes a huge difference.
So just to recap a couple things Johnny mentioned, and this is, you know, this is one of those things that the student ministry leader, as you seek to pour into your students this way and in their discipleship help to open their eyes to the global church and the persecution that's going on. It has to start with you, just like other things that we've talked about on the podcast in a lot of episodes. You know, evangelism, you want your students to share their faith. It has to start with you. And so there are so many things that where that begins. And this is another one of those things that it has to be kindled in your own heart. And educate yourself was one of the things you mentioned, Johnny. Learn from these people and their stories. Pray for them. Advocate for them. Give. Open. And then as you do these things, and I think it is, and as you do these things, lead your students to do them as well so that you walk through this journey together. And then Johnny mentioned open doors as well. And then 10 things you need to know on the global war on Christianity. And producer Nathan will make sure and put links to that and to the Martyr's Oath in our show notes on the blog and all that, so that listeners, you have an easy way to get more information on those. Johnny, as we kind of wrap up here, want to give you the floor just to kind of make the final statement, the message that you would like to deliver to our student pastor, student ministry leader friends.
You know, my heart is that every single leader, Christian leader in this country, would make this issue something that they invest time and energy into. And I do not believe, if you read the New Testament, that there's any wiggle room for us not to care for, advocate for, you know, the persecuted church. And let me just say, like, I don't think that you can have a New Testament Christianity, again, without suffering or being close to those who are. And it is our responsibility as leaders to do that and then to show others how to do it themselves. And so let me just appeal to you. I would get on my knees and beg you, you know, if I was in the same room with you, you know, if there's one thing you do, you know, between now and the end of the year, around Easter next year, whatever, like, be a voice for the persecuted church among those you influence. And I can guarantee not only will it change your life, it'll change the lives of those you minister to, it'll change your church, your student ministry, everything. You know, it is the missing link.
I think it's safe to say that this episode has been a convicting one.
Yeah,
for sure.
And it's a self-challenging one. The story of the nun and the story. When I read the story of Rose and just the image of her shouting Jesus until she could barely speak anymore, is one that's going to stick with me. And so check out The Martyr's Oath, as well as 10 Things You Need to Know on the Global War on Christianity. Both of those are available and out now. Johnny, if people want to connect with you and the ongoing ministry that you're doing, what are some ways that people can do that?
You know, they can just go to martyrsoath.com, and all the information is there. And I love to hear from them. You know, I don't know how many countless people have my cell phone number, my email address, and, you know, I'm very proud to be accessible, so feel free to reach out.
Great. Johnny, thank you so much for taking the time, and thank you for pouring into us and pouring into listeners and bringing awareness on this podcast as well. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
This has been the Lifeway Student Ministry Podcast. Thanks for listening. And like I mentioned earlier, we're going to make sure and have some links in the show notes so that you can connect directly to Johnny's ministry as well as the writings that we mentioned earlier. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.